Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for July 31st, 2011, a fifth show in the month of July. Very rarely do we do five shows in a month, but this is one of those. Welcome, as always, Catherine Smith.
Hello.
Yes, and we're going to do things a little different, but also something we've done a lot on this show. Tim Shiflett has an outrage of the week, but instead of putting it kind of further back in the show, we are going to do, for the, I think, the first time, lead off with Tim's outrage of the week. Tim, welcome, and you go with it.
All right, David. This, if you're a regular listener to the show, this is probably not going to come as a great shock to you, but, you know, I just really have no use for the Tea Party folks. I don't for 1 minute believe that their bull-type entry into national politics has been good for the country at all. And no more prime example of what I'm saying can be found than in this theater of the absurd that we are all witnesses to right now in our nation's capital. Now, I will give the devil his due. I will give the Tea Party credit for one thing. They apparently do say what they mean and mean what they say. They said they were elected for one reason, and they mean to stick to their guns. They're not worried about the next election. They have no thought of the consequences of what they're doing. They don't negotiate what they believe are their principles. And they really don't care what anybody thinks about all of that. Oh, if only ever once in a while some precious few Democrats, especially some in the West Wing, would just occasionally adopt the same posture. But be that as it may, unfortunately, the Tea Party also does not live in the real world, to be honest. Because every once in a great while, I guess, there has to be compromise. That is the only way that much of anything constructive can get done when there is divided government as there is right now. And let me expand on what I just said by mentioning this. When one side caves in and the other side totally gets their way, that's not what I mean by constructive. Look at the example of the last decade. George Bush totally had his way with a willing Congress for almost his entire presidency. And look where that got us. One side totally had their way. I do hope that some folks in Washington take note of that. The Tea Party's idea of negotiation is simple. They keep their principles intact. The negotiation, according to them, involves the other side's principles. In this present debt mess, it has been the Democrats making all the concessions. They really should have made none with concern to the debt ceiling. Because once it started, their side pushed even harder. Since the final year of the Eisenhower administration to the present day, the debt limit has been increased 78 times. It has been done almost routinely until now. But now, its raising is held hostage by 87 Tea Party members of Congress who mean to impose their will. Never mind that this action would throw the global economy into a depression. Never mind that our own fragile economy could be completely derailed. I certainly don't want any of these guys up there to let facts like that get in the way of their principles, I guess. But here's the thing. The debt ceiling and fixing the ills of our federal budget are two separate items. They are not one item. They should not be treated as one item. Raising the debt limit says that we will honor the debts our Congress has already run up. This is not about deficits or borrowing. It is about us keeping our word to our lenders. We are having no trouble borrowing money worldwide now. Borrowing has never been cheaper for the United States. We should pay our bills. Then we can talk about changing the future spending. To do otherwise is irresponsible. And further, to base any further agreements on spending cuts only is also irresponsible. And even further, to allow the party who caused all this mess to start with to dictate all the terms of any agreement is the absolute height of irresponsibility. That's not an agreement. That's blackmail. Now, there have been rumors all day of a tentative agreement in the making. It would contain spending cuts of about $3 trillion over the next 10 years and no tax increases. The cuts would come almost exclusively from programs that benefit the poor, the elderly, the middle class, and children. The concept of shared sacrifice would be reduced to the realm of fodder for late-night comedians then, I guess, because General Electric would continue to pay less taxes than I do. The oil industry would still get their subsidies, and the richest people would continue to pay at the lowest tax rate in history. The cuts that I mentioned, well, those would come out of the hides of the rest of us. 87 of the 535 members of Congress caused all of the events of the last couple of weeks to occur. They interpreted the results of the last election as some sort of mandate for them to do what they please. They now take aim at the very social and economic fabric of this country with the plan of destroying it, and they mean to recreate their concept of a country as they envision it, with no thought to what the rest of us think. An agreement on this one item, this debt ceiling, will end nothing. This is only the beginning. I wish the president would just invoke the 14th Amendment and raise the debt limit, but I don't guess he's going to do that. I'm not sure he has the political courage to do so, and I really hate to say that. But he, along with the rest of us, will be held hostage by this ragtag bunch of sunshine patriots who stand squarely, supposedly, or so it seems, against everything that we stand for. Yeah, I don't like the Tea Party folks, David. I don't.
Yeah, I don't think they have a lot of friends on this show, but I'll say this. I had heard this weekend that David Axelrod's strategy for the re-election campaign of the president is going to be able to fight the Tea Party, you know, just campaign straight against the Tea Party. The GOP nominee, be whoever it is, they're going to paint them as a Tea Party person. One thing is we've got to stand up to them.
When are we going to start contrast?
That's the trick. And I did want to, and you may can clarify this, the Bush tax cuts that they kind of, you know, President Obama let go forward again, do those come up again before a re-election campaign, or do those come up again after?
Those will come after. They would have run out at the end of this year, but now they will have a two-year extension, which it's essentially sends them into 2013.
So that may be when we
the
see
beginning
the big
of
battle. That'll be after a re-election campaign.
Because that's
obviously, it's a two-sided solution in a lot of people. You know, it's like you, and I don't know why the compromise couldn't be something like for every dollar of tax cuts on the rich or taxes on the rich that we add back, we'll agree to cut that many dollars, and therefore it is a shared sacrifice. It's not all on the backs of the poor, the working class, whoever it may be. Catherine, your thoughts on all this?
Well, you know, I don't know if I ever said it on this show, but I know I had these conversations with my friends about the Tea Party people, was that ultimately they were going to screw something up. I didn't identify the debt ceiling as the issue, but I knew that because they don't, so many of them have so little experience, and they're so, zealous, exactly, about their issues, that I mean, you could almost see something coming that where they would be uninformed, inexperienced, and they would screw something up, and they would take us hostage, and that's exactly what they've done. And I think it's shocking that it's kind of shocking to see that 87, you know, people can do this to us
mm-hmm.
as a country, and shame on the Republicans for cowering to them.
Well, Catherine, I was going to ask you about that very thing. And it's about John Boehner. He has not come out of this thing looking very good. Where does
I don't think he's going to last very much longer as Speaker.
I agree with you. What do you think, David?
Anytime, this is just like when Newt Gingrich and the Tea Party got into it. Anytime that the voice of reason in a party is Newt Gingrich or John Boehner, you know that the fringe element really is out there, and that's the case here. And that's the thing. This party is going to decide, Denny Hastert, he was too much to the center. Now John Boehner's too much to the center. And they're going to get further and further away from the, you know, political center and be, you know, where they have to see it with the binoculars or telescope.
Yeah.
And it's going to make them look more and more fringe, and it's going to make them harder and harder to elect
on a large state basis. It is true what you say, but from a practical standpoint, the Speaker, who has an overwhelming majority in the House of Representatives, had to pull his own bill from the floor because he didn't have the votes.
Because they're all afraid of him.
Yeah,
what I think. Not Boehner. They're not afraid of Boehner. They're afraid of the Tea Party people. Because
they're afraid of Jim DeMint of South Carolina. Apparently, Jim DeMint kind of stood down John Boehner, and that's what a lot of this comes from, because Jim DeMint is kind of the new voice of, you know, elected conservatism in Washington. I mean, he's kind of the elected Grover Norquist, if you will, because I think we talked about, you know, who elected this guy, and he has all this power over all these people with this no tax pledge.
Well, then who comes forward as their champion in the House to challenge Boehner? Is it Cantor, or who is it?
Or that Ryan? Paul Ryan, I think, is one of their darlings. You would think they'd almost want this big Southerner, the way they have that, you know, kind of red state, you know, more rural feel, and a Wisconsin guy doesn't necessarily embody that in a cultural sense of who they are, but they seem to like him. Well, I just noticed on the line we have our first guest, Communications Director for the Democratic Party of Georgia, has been on their show before, and he's on again. Mr. Eric Gray, welcome to the Kudzu Vine.
Hello, all. How are y'all?
Hey, Eric. Thanks for being on.
Good evening, Eric.
Hey, how are you? Good to be on.
Yes, for understanding, the Democratic Party of Georgia has put together a day of service on 8/8. August 8th. Can you tell us about what that is and how it came to being? Or is it the 6th? I'm sorry. 8th,
yeah,
6th.
It's actually
it's
on the
Saturday.
6th.
That makes a lot more sense than a Monday.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely it does. Yeah. It'll be August 6th, so we're talking about a little less than a week away. It was an interesting way that we put this together. I was fortunate enough to be talking to a group of Democrats and kind of activists on the phone, and it just kind of grew out of this conversation where they showed this desire to put on some events and trying to decide, okay, do we do an event in Atlanta? Do we do an event in Macon? Do we do more than one event? And eventually it sprouted out to, well, let's see if we can get each county or a lot of the counties involved and invigorated and putting on their own events just for their county party. So out of this phone conversation, we wound up growing to where we are now, which is about 36 events scheduled all over the state of Georgia for next Saturday. And some of them will be celebrating President Obama's birthday, and some of them will be doing service projects. And it's just a very grassroots feel with each county doing their own individual thing.
So it was out of a phone call, if you will. Now, is this just in Georgia, or have other states joined in?
Well, I think some other states are doing some things. I know Move On's doing something. I know the DNC has tried to schedule some things, and those are on the national level. But this August 6th specifically is just Georgia-specific. It's born fresh out of the Democratic Party of Georgia.
Yeah. Well, of course, I'm on the line with Catherine Smith and Tim Shiplett, so I want to give them a chance to ask some questions as well about this. Catherine, questions for Eric.
Well, are they all at the same time, or are they? I mean, I sort of looked at the schedule, but is it like throughout the day on Saturday? So you know, people just be gathering in various places, or?
Sure. You know, that was one of the keys is that we put up some framework for the local counties, and we said, look, it needs to be on August 6th. It needs to be something that's family friendly. It needs to be something that's low or no cost, and other than that, you guys can do what you want. So I think the first event that we have is going to be like a pancake breakfast that they're having to celebrate President Obama's birthday. But many of them are doing things later in the afternoon. There's a cookout happening up in North Georgia from like 7 to 9 o'clock in the evening. It's different events, different times, but the key to it is it's all happening on the same day so that we can show some kind of unity throughout the state.
Well, I think it's great. I think it was a great idea. I have to tell you guys that I was on that call. That original call. So.
No wonder you think it's wonderful, right, Kathy?
No wonder I think it's a wonderful idea. I don't think it was my idea, though. But
well,
I think it is nice. I think it's a good way of showing I think it's a nice way of showing all our county parties that we're thinking about them and that we, you know, we want to be unified. And it's also a way of showing, you know, other people that, wow, look, the Democrats are all organized. They're all having events on the same day. So I think it's good. And I'm looking forward to the one the sneak peek at the new Democratic Party of Georgia headquarters and the gathering with Fulton and Cobb counties over here in Northwest Atlanta.
Sure, absolutely.
Tim?
Well, hello, Eric. First of all, let me apologize. Normally, Chattooga County would be right in the middle of that. But as you may or may not know, we are giving up for our Jefferson Jackson dinner, which just happens to be on the 13th. So we're, shall I say, a little bit slammed getting ready for that right now. But what I was going to ask was a couple of things. You mentioned these individual events all over the state, but as you know, in the metro area, something that comes into play would be the coverage of the Atlanta media. Are there any plans to involve the media in any of the metro events that are going on?
Well, actually, we're going to involve the media in all of the events going on statewide.
Uh-huh.
Now, the one thing that's interesting about Georgia is that, you know, Atlanta is the biggest metropolitan area. It's where the majority of the Democrats in the state live and work. And it's also the hardest media market to try and break into. So
mm-hmm.
We expect that we'll, you know, talk to the AJC and talk to Channel 2 and all these places to try and get coverage. But, you know, even more importantly, I think, in this instance, is the coverage in the Coffee County newspaper. Or the coverage
uh-huh.
up in Habersham County, or the places where it's dedicated red Republican, and they don't see that there's a Democratic Party that's viable in their county. And we need
mm-hmm.
to change that perception. So we're going to be doing a media outreach all over the place, but I tell you what, I'll be thrilled when the Augusta Chronicle covers it, perhaps more so than the AJC, because I know Augusta sometimes feels slighted by a right-wing newspaper there, and they need to have some coverage. So.
I got it. Okay, thank you.
Yeah,
Eric,
I think you're absolutely right. But before Tim may have more questions, but you know, if 10 people roast weenies and give a political speech in Alma, it's a whole lot more likely to get covered than 200 people meeting in Atlanta covered by the Atlanta Constitution.
Sure, agreed. And all media is important, but you know, I'm really, really pushing for places like Valdosta. Or places like, you know, when you look up north, we've got – I'll tell you something interesting. Let me tell you a funny fact about this. the 9th district of our state, probably the most Republican district in the nation. And they are the ones that have really come to bat. I think 80% of the counties up in the 9th district are participating. So I really want to see some good media coverage up there in Lumpkin County and places like that.
Yeah. Tim, I didn't want to cut you off. I just want to kind of reiterate a point.
No, I was through. I was through, David. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, now, Eric, of course, we want to know. You may, your plans may still be tentative, but what events are you looking like you'll be covering or attending?
Well, you know, we're going to have one, a sneak peek at the DPG new headquarters in North, or kind of Mid-Fulton area off of Traybert Avenue.
It's called Northwest Midtown, you guys. West Midtown.
Northwest Midtown. You're right.
No,
West
Midtown.
Midtown.
West Midtown.
Now, I live outside the perimeter, so I might get the names wrong at times.
Yeah, I know.
However.
It's crazy. That's what they call it now, though.
Okay. Very good.
That's what we call it since I live there.
I'm going to swing by there. My home county of Hall is going to have an event, so I'm going to do that. And then I'm also going to go up to Habersham County. What's interesting about Habersham is they've pulled together with three or four other counties, and they're going to have Russell Edwards up there to speak, who was a previous congressional candidate and a current treasurer for the DPG. And then we're also going to have Michael Thurman up there in Habersham. So I'm going to try and go to three different events and waste a little gas, but probably meet some really good Democrats.
Cool. Yeah. Well, Eric, I don't know if this call is for you or if it's for us, but would you mind taking a call?
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah, we have a call on the line from 661.
Hello.
Well, I don't know. That is not our next guest number, so we'll just put that back on hold. But it's good
Eric,
to see people finding the show.
Eric,
however
yes,
they
Eric,
can. Go ahead, Eric.
I was wanting to jump in with one question. Because you are from Hall County, this is a little off the subject, but we are going to be discussing later on in the show redistricting. And Hall County, obviously, is going to be kind of a focal point for that. Are you expecting the new 14th district to be centered in Hall County?
Absolutely. You know, I went to the same high school, just a little bit behind Casey Cagle. And we've grown up with a lot of the same people in our Rolodex over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And these aren't political operatives. These are just good, hardworking Hall County people that we all went to high school with. And they are all solidly Republican. They all go to the meetings, and they all tell me what they hear. And it's been, from the very beginning, it's been known that Hall County was going to be the epicenter because of Nathan Deal and Casey Cagle, and that Casey Cagle might run for it. And I've seen nothing to change my opinion of that at all.
Hmm.
Yeah, well, we'll piggyback in on that. We do want to discuss those maps pretty soon anyway. What are the chances that Rob Woodall jumps into that district, thinking in time that the district he would currently be in, as according to that map that was floated, which may not be anything real to it, but it was a very Gwinnett-based district, which Gwinnett County right now is Republican, but is becoming more Democratic, and as every cycle goes by, will become more and more Democratic. What are the chances he says, look, that Hall County Center district's going to be Republican for a long time? Maybe I just pull out of this Gwinnett thing right at the get-go and get in that safe district.
You know, I wouldn't be surprised. You know, Rob Woodall moving from the 7th district to the 9th district would require him just to change his post office, box office address. He, from what I understand, pretty much lives in Washington. I understand that he's not here in his own district very often. And if you remember, he never lived in the 7th district. Before, he was just John Linder's chief of staff or something pretty high up with John Linder. So I don't think he has a whole lot of investment in the 7th District, and I don't think it'd be hard for him at all to jump 15 miles north and decide to stay in Hall County for a while to win that seat.
Yes, well, then a follow-up on that question, how do you think GOP leaders that have probably – looked at this as a Hall County district and probably want a Hall County person in there will receive Rob Woodall's possible move?
Wow, that's a great question. You know, I don't know. I don't know if he has the Georgia credibility to get a whole lot of people behind him if he decided to do that.
There's,
there's Georgians with that look at credibility when they're electing people.
Well, I think what they look what they look at is this person from Georgia or is this person from outside of Georgia?
Oh, I see. Okay.
You know what I mean? And they'll say, well,
he's
a carpetbagger. Now, it doesn't work in the 7th District. Everyone in 7th District loved Linder and voted for him multiple times. They didn't do that in Hall County. And I don't know if Nathan Deal and Casey Cagle are going to give him the same kind of endorsement and attention as they would if it was someone who was more handpicked by the leaders here in Georgia.
Yeah, and certainly there's a difference between somebody moving down from Michigan, setting up roots, knowing the difference between Midtown and North Central South Midtown, and somebody comes down to run and never really lives in the district. So, Catherine, we'll let you know that you're a different kind of Georgian than Rob Woodall.
Okay.
In case you were wondering. Well, Eric, while we got you on the phone, anything else on your mind that you know about that we don't, that the people of the South or Georgia and Democratic circles should know?
Well, I'll make one comment on this debt ceiling thing, since it's been such a big horrible mess there in Washington. I'd like to say a word or two about it. You know, I heard a lot of what you guys were saying before I came on, and I want to echo, I think it was David that mentioned this, but, you know, if you've got the voices of reason that are trying to propose a debt solution in Washington, and those people wind up being Saxby Chambliss and or Johnny Isaacson, that tells you how far right the United States Congress has gone.
Amen.
You know, Johnny Isaacson actually proposed a bill yesterday that I don't like, but it showed some level of compromise with the Democratic and the Republican positions. And, you know, to some small degree, I admire that because he's actually a statesman trying to get stuff done. I don't like the plan, but if he's the one who's compromising, and Saxby Chambliss is part of the Gang of Six, and he's the one who's trying to get us out of a budget impasse with Tea Party Republicans, then you know that we're in bad shape up in D.C.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Eric, this may be a difficult question, but of the current congressional delegation, because obviously the two senators would not be the answer, of the Georgia congressional delegation, which one do you think is the most aligned with the Tea Party?
I would say probably Tom Graves.
I agree with you.
You know, I think Paul Brown is there, but he's also a little wacky and he can go off the reservation, right? You got Jack Kingston, who aligns with the Tea Party, and Westmoreland and Gingrey and Austin Scott, but they all, with the exception of Austin Scott, have all been there for a while and have, you know, built up some relationships and some loyalties that make it hard for them to be hardcore Tea Party people. And Austin Scott, who is a Tea Party guy, is now in the leadership with John Boehner. So, which is remarkable for a Republican, a freshman, to get a reasonably high position in the Congress. So, I think I'd have to go with Tom Graves.
Yeah, I don't think you're far off with that. So, this is going to be interesting to continue to watch these negotiations, and of course, a lot of us will be out, and I'm sure our listeners will be out at different events next week, and we'll be glad you told us about it. And maybe we can even get some reviews of different events, and you can even send us a little line on which ones are the most successful that we might not know about because the local paper didn't cover them yet.
Sure, I'll be glad to do that. And I encourage everyone, if you'd like to see what events are going on near your area, just go to georgiademocrat.org, and we've got a list of all 36 events there.
Yes. Well, Eric, thanks again for coming on Cozy Vine.
Thanks, Eric. I'll see you Saturday.
Thank you, Eric.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Yes. Well, it's good to have Eric on. And Anastasia Afa is going to be on week here in about 5 minutes. She's going to come on and talk about Florida politics. In the meantime, we've got way too many topics to begin to discuss. One that I thought might fit in here nicely that came across my radar screen was Rush Limbaugh's coining of the new term overeducated. Now, I didn't get this from Rush Limbaugh because I have better things to do than listen to him, but I did listen to the Keith Olbermann podcast, and he was talking about how Rush Limbaugh is talking about the Democratic alliance, if you will, and the different people that make it up and how unimportant they all were. And apparently the new group in that is the overeducated. Now, Tim, Catherine, I always learned that getting education was a good thing, a mind was a terrible thing to waste. all those things. But apparently, according to the leader of conservative thought, you can be over-educated. Tim, what do you make of this?
Does that mean that, you know, that everything has to have an opposite, I guess? Does that mean that his side is undereducated? Or?
That may be. But apparently it's a bad thing, though, to be too educated. Rush Limbaugh apparently is a college dropout, and the rest of his family has at least a four-year degree, if not a law doctorate, doctoral degree in medicine, whatever it may be. So it may be that he has a little bit of envy, a little bit of feelings of ineptitude, if you will. Catherine, what do you think about the over-educated?
Well, as I've freely admitted lately, I have my moments where I listen to Hannity and Erickson on 750. And this has actually been a theme for the last couple, I've heard it a few times. You know, all these, you know, professors who are, you know, serving in the cabinet and all these heads, and I don't think there are that many. I think that is a tradition that has actually gone by the wayside since probably Nixon, not any intellectuals serving in the cabinet. But I think it's just ironic that there's to be the, you know, in Georgia anyway, they're always talking about education, but we're going to be now overeducated. It's just another, little sound bite that sounds good to people in middle America, feel like they maybe don't have the same education as the president. There's been a lot of talk about, well, how the heck did he get into Harvard and blah, 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 and how did he pay for it, you know, all that. So it's just another way of, you know, putting a wedge between people. It's just one more wedge that we have to try to overcome.
Yeah. Tim, the other day, I think on Facebook, we were talking about the Republican Party being able to go to McDonald's and recruit candidates from the clowns that work there. Literally, the one with big feet. I'm not disparaging any of the people that work the drive-thru.
Don't you think this new little cute thing to say is a replacement term for elite? You know, they were very fond of using elite and elitist for a while, and that probably was over the heads of a lot of people. But if you say overeducated, everybody punches each other. A bunch of liberal hippie professors, blah, 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 you know.
Well, I mean, but that's the thing. This is actually a broader umbrella because I don't think anybody would call me elite, but then I do have a lot of extra pieces of paper. I mean, I have two masters and a specialist in part of my doctoral work, so even though people listening might not believe it, I might
plus you're a political liberal, so old Rush has got you pegged just right.
I guess I fit. But what I was going to get to is this sounds like the Republican Party may have a new way to recruit candidates and future leaders. What they do is they go into a place where people are working on the GED. They say, drop out now. Before you get too much education, you're no good to us. You know, I mean, do y'all think that's a tactic they could use?
You know,
I don't think you like that.
It sounds like a legitimate. I mean, if you really are going to accuse people of being overeducated, then why wouldn't you do that?
Yeah, overeducated. That's I just thought that was just too unusual in a time in which everybody thinks, you know, education's good. The more job skills you have, the more employment you can obtain. But, Rush Limbaugh, I guess, wants you to stay uneducated, and that may show how
Let's put it this way. Of the unemployed in this country, 4% of the college-educated people are unemployed. Of the unemployed in this country, 12% of the people with high school educations are unemployed, and 16% with less than a high school degree are unemployed. Well, does that sound like a game set in match step? It does to me.
Well, I just want to say one more thing. In the big scheme of things, I totally don't disagree with the concept that we do urge people to go to college and get education that might not be great for them at the expense of trade schools and other skill building. I always say we don't have enough plumbers because God knows they cost an arm and a leg and you can never get one. But there's been an eroding respect, I think, in this country for anyone who does, you know, any kind of trained skill, like a plumber or an electrician or a trained welder or those kind of jobs. They've got the bottom of the pile. Whereas my grandfather was a plumber and he made a very good living and he was very proud of his work. He was a member of a labor union. He built a beautiful house for my grandmother and my mother and aunt lived in it. And it was, he was a middle-class man, even though he was a plumber. So I think that we do overemphasize higher education, college education, at the expense of these other options that may be better for some people graduating from high school. But I don't think they're overeducated because you're still getting educated if you go to plumbing school.
He may be talking about the guy that gets every single degree at the technical school, though, too.
It's
absolutely valuable to have technical schooling. There is absolutely nothing wrong with technical schooling at all.
But don't you think there's a de-emphasis on that? I think there is over the last two decades a de-emphasis on technical training and an emphasis just on, going to college.
Anybody that de-emphasizes it does it to their own peril. I do think a lot of people, there may be a lot of parents out there that's like, oh, that's a great choice, just not for my child.
Right.
And sometimes you need to have a realistic view at times.
Yeah,
I think we have our next guest on the line. Tim, throw in your last point quickly.
No, go ahead. Go ahead, David.
Welcome our next guest from Florida, a longtime friend of the show, Miss Anastasia Apa. Welcome, Apa.
Ah, it's great to be on again. Hello, Dave, and hello, Beth, and hey.
Thanks
for
being on.
Good to have you online.
Good evening, Apa.
Yeah.
Hey, there, too.
Yeah, well, let's talk a little about Florida, and even though it kind of heated up last week and we talked about it, but we don't live in Florida, so we don't know what it's really like you do. Representative Alan West and Representative Debbie Wasserman Schultz really got into it deeply. Apparently, Representative West, who's actually represented by Ms. Wasserman Schultz in the House, really attacked her. What are people thinking there in Florida about this?
Well, I have to say, I haven't polled many of my friends on the topic, but I've read some articles recently, and the fact that he would call her the most despicable and vile member of the U.S. House of Representatives, I think, is absolutely preposterous. I mean, this goes beyond politics. I mean, he even calls it personal. Congressman West has gone a little bit beyond what I think is acceptable from any human being to another human being. So I'd like to point my finger at both of them and tell them to sit down and stop it and set a better example for people. I mean, can't we all just get along?
Apparently not.
Okay. Yeah, but obviously, and I remember when I was an assistant principal, I would tell boys, anytime you get in a spat with a female, you're always going to look bad. And in this case, he's this guy that wants to be this Army-trained gentleman, and he just looks very unclassy in the way he's handled things. So I think he's going to come out the loser in this, no matter which way you cut it. And it seems to be already happening around him. And I think that also his district is a pretty swingable district, correct, Apa?
Yeah, it's a seat that for a long time Democrats felt pretty safe in, and definitely one I know the D-Trip and other folks are focused in on trying to win back. you know, the fact that these kinds of political back and forth are happening, I think is unfortunate at a time when we really should be talking about important issues like how we're going to fix our spending problems and how we're going to get people back to work here in America. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, whether he, you know, whether Congressman West was a man speaking to a woman or not, you know, I feel like Congresswoman Schultz, you know, really shouldn't engage him at this point. And the fact that he sent an email, I think, is crazy. He calls her Debbie and said he'll oblige her to having a personal fight. I mean, just above and beyond, a little disgusting, and definitely a moment of shame. We should get one of those sound effects, Dave, where we go like, boom, thumbs down.
Yeah. Well, that was just one hot topic in the Sunshine State. Now, of course, I could keep asking questions, but I want to be fair to Catherine and Tim and let them ask some questions about Florida politics. Catherine, what are some questions you have?
Well, how are things going in Congressman Wasserman Schultz's district? Are people okay with being the DNC chair and continuing to serve as a congresswoman? Like, is that an issue at all? I've wondered about.
Yeah, I think there may be a little bit of a disconnect between, you know, voters in her district. You know, at the end of the day, people look at their congressional representatives and their elected officials, really. Do I like these people? Do I feel like these people do a good job for me? You know, her approval ratings are, they're respectable. I think she's a good connection to her constituency. She's definitely got a high name recognition in her district and really throughout the state of Florida. So I feel like, you know, voters are not really thinking about her as the DNC chair. And I know they see her as more vocal. I wonder if they even realize why she's as prominent a figure as she is. But I feel like overall they're happy with the job that she's doing. And the congresswoman should be safe, yeah.
Yeah, because she's like a superwoman. She's everywhere.
Yes, she is.
You know.
She does a fantastic job of that.
I don't have any more questions off the top of my head, so I'm going to pass it to Tim and think for a minute.
Well, good evening, Napa. How are you doing?
Hey, Tim.
Listen, one thing that has really interested me about Florida is the fact that now we noticed that Mike Haradopoulos has quit the U.S. Senate race, and that essentially leaves no big-name Republican to run against Senator Nelson. Has he pretty much got his race wrapped up already, do you think?
Like, I think it's still early in the election cycle. But one thing I can definitely tell you is that when we think of Senator Nelson, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, you have a warm feeling in your heart for the guy. You know, you almost mm-hmm. believe, it's a misnomer here, that he, you know, was an astronaut. But he just kind of makes you feel good. I think he's going to be safe. But again, I mean, we just don't know kind of what's going to happen here. Florida is one of those states right now where people are really sitting back. And a mm-hmm. lot of the times our state leads in terms of kind of getting up, getting the money raised. But all the candidates that I've spoken to and just the feel of the ground here is I see a lot of people making slow strategic moves towards making decisions about running, mounting campaigns, getting in races, and it's just a different kind of cycle here in the Sunshine State. And I think that as the cycle kind of speeds up, I think we're going to see a little bit of action out of some early folks in August, and I'm certainly in the beginning of January it's going to become a zoo. So you guys stay tuned, and I look forward to talking about that more.
Okay. And on the other end of the spectrum, I've noticed in the latest opinion polls that your governor, Scott, is still very unpopular down there. Why is he so unpopular or continues to be?
Well, the last report that I saw said he had a 58% disapproval rating. That's right there in early July. So that's pretty fresh. And it's a huge sample size. We're talking about 1,000 voters polled. Everybody knows any poll over 300 is pretty respectable. If you're talking about a statewide, mm-hmm. you're looking at 700, that's respectable. So to say we talked to 1,000 of Floridians and 58% said they didn't like the guy, I can safely say he's in trouble. Now, you know, it's not surprising because, you know, again, whether you're talking about small town in Mississippi or you're talking about the state of Florida in Miami, we are feeling the recession, and the voters, people who are not voting, we're all feeling it. And at the end of the day, we've got to have, as Democrats, some smart solutions about what we're going to do now. Where is this change? That's what people are saying. And so where and how are we going to go about improving our local economies? How are we going to improve infrastructure? How are we going to create more jobs for people? That's what's on the top of voters' minds. And apparently Rick Scott's not answered that question over the last 4 years, and it's going to be hell to pay.
All right. Thank you, Arthur. David.
Yes, well, talking about Florida and it being a presidential swing state, and it is the very epitome of that term, but Florida's a little trickier than most years even, in that if you look at the president, he has become very popular with a lot of groups in the Democratic constituency, but two groups, Jewish voters and older voters, have been a little slower to warm up to him. Given that fact, if that kind of holds steady throughout November 2012, what problems is that going to pose in winning Florida for the Democratic Party?
Look, I mean, I've seen different kinds of polling about how the Jewish American voters are feeling about our president. You know, it doesn't mean that in 2012 he's not going to win. It doesn't mean that, you know, that because he's doing, you know, some polls have showed us that one group is not feeling a little excited about it, but he's not going to do well. I think we have a bigger problem, Mr. President, and I think that's the fact that we've got to do a lot more to, you know, again, just vocalize a plan about how that change is going to become real. When are people going to start seeing that on their dinner tables? How are we going to get these younger voters back out? How are we going to reengage African-American voters? How are gay voters feeling? You know, he doesn't just have a Jewish voter problem. He has a voter problem, Dave, and Tim and Catherine, and we've got to do something about it. Otherwise, we're going to have a hard time. And I think if the president suffers, you know, Democrats up and down the ticket suffer. So I think, you know, we've got to put our heads together and start to lay some action steps on the table here about what the plan is.
Yeah. Well, I've still got two more topics to ask about, but Catherine may have wanted to ask about one of those, so I want to steal anything from her. Catherine, you got any more?
I'm good. Go ahead, David.
Okay. Redistricting, APA. We've been talking about this with every state because it's time to talk about it, and obviously Florida actually is gaining seats, which makes it even a little more important and exciting. What rumors have you been hearing on how Florida's congressional delegation will change?
Yeah, well, there have been a lot of rumors. I know that we're looking at around January before we really know anything. There's been a lot of talk about, you know, creating more African-American districts. I've heard talk about us having Hispanic districts. Some people say it's going to be in South Florida. I even said that at one point, I think with you guys. And then now I hear it's up in the Orlando area. I mean, we just don't know. There are some good updates that happened on the redistricting website, but they're few and far between in the last few days. So we don't know if it's going to be Ocala or Orlando area, if it's going to be in South Florida. We don't know if it's going to affect, you know, creating a boundary for more African-American voters or more Hispanic voters here in the state. There's even been talk amongst Hispanics that they're going to create more lines of Colombians or other South Americans and separate out Cuban districts. Again, this is one of those big reasons, guys, why we're having so much hesitation from candidates who have just decided to hold off for a second and kind of see not just how the political field plays out here, but how the district may look. And so, you know, we're looking forward to January.
Yeah, well, that'll be exciting to see and interesting to see how all that falls out, because that will affect everything else in Florida. Well, Papa, we thank you again for coming on with us. And before I let you go, though, one question I'd like to ask, is there anything going on with Florida that we didn't ask about that people need to know about?
Well, I think, you know, just here in the state of Florida, there's a lot going on. And there are some, you know, really exciting things happening. For example, in the South Florida seats down here, we've got these pretty hot seats, 21, 25, and 18. They're called the Cuban seat sometimes. The D-Trip and national players, Emily's List and others, have remained active in at least 18 or at least 21, 25, and 18, if you're talking about the D-Trip. The kinds of races that you keep your eyes on because, for example, Congresswoman Ross Lehtinen, now in her 26th year representing the congressional district in 18. She had a kind of a great race against Annette Tadeo, the first Democrat to ever raise $1 million plus in that district in 08. Tadeo did not run against her in 10, and so there's been some talk about Tadeo running there in 25, actually, not in 18, where there's becoming a really, really wide opening there because you've got obviously a Republican who's in trouble. And there's been an official announcement from El Bombero, as he's called, Luis Garcia, who is kind of a local figure here, who's decided to take his swing at a federal race. And so just kind of a lot of movement down here, and then there's really, really exciting race happening up north with Lewis Frankel, who's an Emily's List-supported candidate. He's getting ready to run up there in that Orlando seat again, still trying to wait and see what seat exactly is going to open up or if it's going to be an existing seat there against Mahoney. So just a lot happening kind of on the federal level. I think it's going to be a hot year down here for politics in general. And I think Florida is going to just be important and in play, especially when we talk about our presidential elections. Just an important state overall. Really, where you are too, guys, you know, Atlanta, Georgia, state of Georgia is important too. There's just so much going on. So I appreciate you guys having me on and blab a bunch.
Yeah,
we love having you on.
Yeah, bring the Florida information, and Florida is so critical to everything going on in the country and the South.
Ah, thank you.
Thank you, Alpha. Thanks again.
All right, see you again. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Yeah, well, I tell you what, let's go ahead and move from Florida and APA talking about that over to the other our big population state in the South, and that's Texas. And we have just talked about old Rick Perry, but he continues to make news or people find out more about him. And I had never heard how much until this week he and President George W. Bush don't like each other. I knew that they weren't deep political allies like that. Just because he was lieutenant governor didn't mean that he had been put on the ticket by George Bush as governor. But I had no idea that they just really, there was a deep disdain. They were from very different backgrounds, and they come from different parts of the Republican Party of Texas. And I'm wondering, if Rick Perry makes this move, will George Bush work against him openly or behind the scenes, or will he fall in line since he'll be expected to because he's from Texas? Tim, what do you think?
I think if he does what ex-presidents do, any work he does will be behind the scenes because it would not look dignified for an ex-president to openly campaign in a Republican field. So I don't think that he will do anything except perhaps work behind the scenes. And you're right, David. There's a long history of animosity there. You know, Perry was Bush's lieutenant governor. The lieutenant governor-governor relationship in Texas is a little bit different than it is in Georgia because a lieutenant governor in Texas has a little more power, and so they probably locked horns on several occasions. Perry was nobody until Karl Rove plucked him from obscurity or whatever, and you hit on something else. They're from very different backgrounds, but no, I don't think President Bush would openly campaign against him.
Yeah, well, people might argue, too, that George W. Bush was probably nobody until he was born, halfway between third base and home with a silver spoon in his mouth, because obviously his daddy was born on third. He was born a little closer to home plate. You might could even say he was born in the left side of the batter's box heading home. But, you know, that's so. But that's just so interesting. Of course, you would have the older George Bush that would not, you know, you would think he would fall in line with his son, and they would both work behind the scenes, and that might get some of their people, which still have some pull. And obviously, if Karl Rove plucked him out of obscurity, then he might go up against the two former President Bushes, if you will, if he considers this his guy and this his ticket back to the White House. Catherine, what is your take on all this?
Well, first of all, I don't think George Bush is interested in doing anything. I mean, I think he's, you know, playing golf or whatever, chopping wood.
He doesn't play golf, Catherine. He cuts shrubs. I mean, he
still cuts shrubs because he's not living it. Didn't he sell that ranch?
I don't know.
Anyway,
I mean, I've never heard anybody.
It doesn't seem like he's that engaged right now. Like, he doesn't seem too involved. Now, of course, that could change, but I agree with Tim. I think it's pretty bad form, both for the former president and for the party, for someone to work for or against a candidate in the primary. Now, the exception, of course, was Bill Clinton when Hillary was running, but they're married to each other, so that's a little bit different. But yeah, I don't see him making a big splash either for or against any of the candidates. I think he's gonna, you know, I think we should expect to see him after the primaries are over and at the convention and all that. But I don't think the, you know, lead up to the convention we're gonna see that much of him. Maybe he'll be working behind the scenes, but I would be surprised if he did a lot of that too.
Yeah, and then, of course, after the primary, any influence will be pretty negligible because, obviously, they may want to hide him because then he would help make the president's case, hey, I inherited this mess from this guy. Why put his replacement in office? To me, if Rick Perry was indeed the nominee, I just don't think you see much out of him. Obviously, he does the obligatory Republican National Convention speech. But beyond that,
we all know Michelle Bachmann's going to be the nominee, right?
She might be, who knows with that
God.
Party. You know, like I said, the only one that really worries me in a lot of ways is Huntsman, and we've kind of dismissed him as having a chance because somebody like me likes you as a, you know, me being a Democrat, you're probably sunk anyway. There's another issue with Rick Perry, and that'll probably kind of close out our show. Rick Perry last year had the travel records as governor sealed. Now, usually no one does this at all. Tim, is he hiding something, or is he just not wanting anybody to nosy into his business?
Well, this probably would have never seen the light of day as a news story, except the governor went to the Bahamas, and he apparently used taxpayer money to rent golf carts and scuba equipment, and the Texas Department of Public Safety in the meantime, controlled, of course, by the Republicans, is refusing to publicly release records of costs associated with security during the governor's travels, which lately are quite extensive because he's campaigning all over the country and he's doing a book tour and this and that and the other. So suddenly people are saying, wait a minute, what's he hiding? Because he's becoming a national player. I've heard it.
But the big question is, did he go to Argentina?
Yeah, well, and Catherine, you bring that
up
as a joke. But honestly, is this not an effect of Mark Sanford's ongoing travel problems? You know, you kind of then think, travel, what's he hiding? And then, boom, Mark Sanford kind of comes up. Now, I'm sure Rick Perry doesn't have any Argentine lovers down there that he has to travel around. But it brings up those questions, and anytime anybody's asking questions like this, it's not a net positive for you.
Well, it happens in both parties to be, you know, to be fair, I mean, John Edwards, what was he hiding? Bill Clinton, what was he hiding? Richard Nixon, the champion of hiders. And a free press has never again taken these guys running for president at their word about anything, nor probably should they. So if he's hiding something, he better get it out in the open and right now, or some bright boy will go find it. Right?
Yeah. Yeah, but anything that makes you see, one of the things I think he has over, say, a Michelle Bachmann or a Sarah Palin, while they're both kind of the fair-haired children of the right-wing movement, people are going to say, he's more electable. Anything that hurts that facade or reality of electability hurts him. Well, I've seen a yellow flash up on the control panel, which means we're in recording time. So usually that's kind of a good sign that we need to wrap this thing up. But until
right.
next week, I want to thank Anastasia Hoppe and Eric Gray for being on the Kudzu Vine.
Good night, guys.
Good night, guys.
Good night, everybody.